Bring your sleeping bag.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 16th. I'm going to roll the following bills over. House Bill 2002. House Bill 2356. House Bill 3206. House Bill 3437. House Bill 3365. House Bill 3503. And House Bill 2936. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3233. And we may have to interrupt that meeting. I have another representative coming in who's on limited time, but we'll get this one started. I'd like to call Representative Mr. Mannix and Mr. Tenenberg, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3233 allows a person whose driving privileges are revoked to petition the court for a probationary driver permit. It specifies that the application may occur no sooner than 5 years after the person is released on parole or post-prison supervision, sentenced to probation, revoked from probation, or sentenced for another crime which revoked the driving privileges. It provides that the district attorney will be served as the respondent for the petition. House Bill 3233 states that the court must find clear and convincing evidence that a person is rehabilitated, does not pose a threat to public safety, and has completed all required treatment before a permit is issued. These are the dash one amendments that I've described, which replace the measure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kenmer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Bill Kenmer, State Representative, District 39. And, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 3233. And as was said by the administrator, we are looking at the Dash 1 amendments, please. And I would start off by saying a special thanks goes to Kevin Mannix, who is with me today, and also to Doug Harkelrode, who provided important input to these amendments. Kevin and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance support the bill as amended, and Kevin will speak after me. Mr. Harkelrode, who represents both the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and the Oregon District Attorneys Association, is not taking a position on the amended bill. Much of my professional life as a psychologist has been dedicated to helping people redeem their lives. And through my stepson, Doug, I've learned a lot about DUI laws. Mostly that history is that it's taken a long time for our laws to get appropriately serious. We now have strong laws that guide and protect us, and I think that's appropriate and extremely important. But they offer little for rehabilitation and restoration. Let me share a little story about Doug because he is the inspiration for this bill. For about 20 years, Doug was a serious alcoholic, drinking sporadically, often, and hard. I was in court about 4 years ago when he was convicted of DUII for what in a complicated way amounted to essentially his fifth DUI in 20 years. His license was revoked for life. He was an angry, belligerent 38-year-old alcoholic, and his harsh sentence made sad sense. Fortunately or miraculously, his record included no accidents or injuries to others. Skipping ahead some difficult months, Doug is about to have his formal revocation start and arrives at our fishing cabin in Scottsburg about 8 a.m., some 2 days late and not in very good shape. Sherry and Carla, which is Doug's wife, along with their two young children, were scared and huddled in the back bedroom, and I was scared too as I met him in the living room. The short of it is, I confronted Doug with, you're an alcoholic and you need to get into treatment. And if you don't, you're going to lose your wife, your children, likely your life, and unless you're very lucky, you may take someone else with you. There was a long, stressful silence. It was a difficult moment. And then Doug said, I need to get in treatment, but I can't afford it. I responded, if you're serious, your mom and I will pay for it. That was the best $8,500 we've ever spent. The story goes on. Doug calls almost daily. Once a month, we've gotten a call like a few weeks ago. 43 months was the inspired comment, indicating that he's been safe, he's been clean and sober for 43 months and counting. Wonderful time. After lots of struggles, Doug has a good construction job, but he often works out of town, Often his boss has to send a second person to drive, and his boss is concerned about the money and hassle. Can't seem to understand why the law doesn't allow Doug a hardship or probationary permit with a breathalyzer, and at times grows impatient and sometimes worse than that. And Carla suffers the punishment, too. Everywhere the family goes, she must drive, and with public transportation inadequate at best, Carla has to drive Doug often to work, the doctor, and everywhere else when he can't get a bus or a ride, which is a big burden to Carla as well. Under current law, Doug has to wait a minimum of 10 years and then apply for a very limited and difficult-to-obtain hardship permit. I'm very proud of Doug. He refuses to drive illegally and refuses to go, as many have suggested, to another state and fraudulently get a license. But do you see the connection? No wonder a whopping 50 to 75% of life-suspended drivers drive anyway. They drive illegally, and they drive, consequently, without insurance, and assuring that if and when they get caught, they never get their license back. Life without redemption, rehabilitation, and hope is pretty tough. And few, if any, of us haven't needed forgiveness and a new start from time to time. And if Doug weren't working out of town today, he'd be here to talk about this personally. Let me add a few important clarifications, and actually the administrator mostly covered these, but I want to mention these again. Who is not eligible under this bill? Because we are creating a narrow window. We're not making this wide open. Who is not eligible? A person convicted of an additional motor vehicle crime during the revocation period, the original crime caused physical injury, a person who does not comply with future responsibility filings, a person who receives an additional revocation, a person who does not comply with the standards of 807.270, which are completion of a driver improvement course, a medical exam showing physical and mental competency, and a court order pursuant to this bill, a person who does not comply with the Nation Interlock Program. There also are high standards. Before the court reissues privileges, it will consider the nature of the crime, the person's relevant criminal and non-criminal behavior, the PO's recommendation based on a psych eval, and any other, quote, any other relevant factors. And before issuance, the court must find by clear and convincing evidence that the person is rehabilitated, the person poses no threat to public safety, and the person has completed any required treatment program. Kevin Mannix of the Anti-Crime Alliance will explain further on the details and will discuss his support of the amended bill. I have a letter from Chad Lentz, which is in OLIS, which I would encourage you to read, because he does a great job of discussing how this amended bill would help folks in his situation and similar situations. And with me also to testify after Kevin is Joshua Thunberg. He's here to share personally his story. Joshua is another success story. And in fact, he'll be speaking soon at the Oregon Association of Drug Court Professionals celebratory event here at the Capitol next month. Please review the DMV chart I've also put through OLIS that provides reports about the number of court-ordered DUI, lifetime DUI revocations. I believe this bill will give hope and encouragement to a modest number of Doug-like men and women who are in the process of redeeming their lives. And let me conclude with Doug's words to me. Bill, I need a little light at the end of the tunnel. This bill will provide some much-needed light at the end of the tunnel for some folks working to redeem themselves. I thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3233-1.
Thank you. Mr. Mannix.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney here in Salem. I come to you today as a person with a significant perspective and background in regard to public safety. My last service in five terms in the House was as chair of the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law, in which we proudly moved 172 bills, 171 of which actually passed the Senate and were passed into law. So I believe in productivity, I believe in the criminal justice process, and I support public safety. As a citizen, I've been the author of five successful citizen initiatives on public safety, and as a legislator, I'm proud of the fact that I pushed through 85 bills during my 10 terms on public safety, public safety, not other issues. I mention this because I come to you in a different capacity today, but in the capacity of someone who has been through this process many times. I am president of the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance out here in the civilian sector, and we do believe in law enforcement, we do believe in accountability, but we also believe in rehabilitation. And this bill has been carefully recrafted with the Dash 1 amendments to provide what I would call a shopping list of requirements that somebody is going to have to go through to have demonstrated true rehabilitation, which is worthy of consideration by a judge, but which still requires the judge to be satisfied by clear and convincing evidence that it's appropriate to proceed and allow this person the opportunity to drive. And even then, the Division of Motor Vehicles will simply be issuing a probationary license under ORS 807.270, which itself is a restrictive, time-consuming process. So there is a very careful process here of making sure the person has demonstrated rehabilitation. This is the clearest, closest case, I think, of coming to a pure sense of rehabilitation in terms of performance under the standards imposed by this bill, and then having to continue to demonstrate that working with DMV with a probationary license. It is a narrowly crafted bill because it is intended to be targeted at true cases of rehabilitation. One could argue that over time, more ought to be done to provide more opportunities for rehabilitation, especially for those affected by drugs or alcohol. That will be a good conversation for another day. But this was an attempt to present you with a bill that is targeted, that is specific, that is worthy of your consideration and passage. And I do want to mention a couple of other things. You're going to hear today, I am sure, well, the ignition interlock system doesn't really work as well as it should because we need to have more things done to make enforcement better. Yes, you should. This is not an ignition interlock reform bill. This is not an ignition interlock refresher bill or refurbishment bill. That's an issue that does need to be addressed, but it does take an existing safety device and system and use it along with a number of other factors. I mention this just because I'm anticipating some of the contrary arguments. In fact, probably the major contrary argument. I invite this committee, I urge this committee to address that. There may be task forces that are working on that issue, but don't allow the opportunity to carry out this rehabilitation program to be set aside simply because some elements of our public safety system still need repair or refurbishment. I would also like to address the issue of accountability because we have already held a person accountable under the legislation that exists on the books today. The other side of the equation is rehabilitation. I talked about that at the beginning of my remarks. I hope that this committee will consider the Dash 1 amendments. And finally, there is one objection I heard about that I, or concern or question that I do want to address since I may not get a chance to testify again on this bill. What if the person fails the probationary restrictions? What if the person does not succeed with this rehabilitation? I think the odds are very low, but the reality is I don't think a judge will ever again give that person a second chance under this regime. I think this is a one-chance opportunity for somebody to move on with his or her life, and I urge the committee to take a look at this as a good, narrow bill, adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and send this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman and Representatives, for the opportunity to speak to you. I'm Joshua Thunberg. I'm a grateful member of a community support group system, and I am an alcoholic drug addict. I'm also a chronic reoffending DUII person. Throughout my life, I've made a lot of terrible decisions that have affected my family, friends, and community adversely. Although in February 2012, I was given the opportunity to enter a guilty plea and join Clackamas County's DUII court program under, at that time, Judge Ron Tom, and then subsequently under Judge Susie Norby. Through those 3 years of incarceration, probation, first formal, and then bench probation, repeated visits to the court to do checkups, I successfully graduated this past February and was formally released from all probation and all recurrent penalties that could happen if I failed. As it stands now, I'm a gainfully employed individual. I work full-time in a maintenance field. I'm also a felon, so I cannot live on site. I have to live further outside of the urban growth zone in order to find a place where they will accept felons to live. to get to work, it's relying on public transportation and the kindness of others, especially my mother, who's present with me here today, which I willfully do. I want to be an upstanding, respectable citizen. I want to be accountable, and everything I've done has been to demonstrate those things. And so I don't choose to drive without a license. I don't want to be that person anymore. I've done enough crime in my life, and I've taken enough from innocent people, that is not my goal in life anymore. If allowed, if this bill passes and is allowed, I'm still 2 years out before I could even apply for this, as I've only had 3 years since my conviction and 3 years since my lifetime revocation. Representative Kenemer had said from Doug that he needs a light at the end of the tunnel, and I will echo that sentiment, that a light at the end of the tunnel is good, and also the belief that it's not a train. Having given the opportunity to clean away the legal wreckage of my past and doing, through my community support groups, an opportunity to clean away the personal wreckage of my past, I look forward to an opportunity where I can further clear my name and be given an opportunity to demonstrate to my fellows that I have changed and that I can continue to change, but that growth is not a temporary thing and growth is not a stagnant thing. It must continue to be worked on and must be continued to be shown. Having a license, yeah, would make going to work real easy. But to me, what matters most is being able to help people within my own community. I have cards. I didn't bring enough for everybody, otherwise I would give one out to you. But I have cards made up that have my name, just my first name, my phone number, and on the back it says, for questions on sobriety. A lot of sponsors within these programs take newcomers to meetings. I cannot do those things. I can only hope that the people that call me will meet me at that meeting that I'm at and make myself available to those individuals. If given the opportunity, this would greatly help those things. But I also realize that I am the architect of my own destruction. Nobody did these things to me. I did these things to myself. So I'm grateful for the chance to come and speak with you all and potentially given further opportunities to demonstrate rehabilitation or better yet, redemption. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And I'm going to suspend this hearing for a few minutes, and I'm going to call up House Bill 33, open a public hearing on House Bill 3388, and call up Representative Evans, please.
Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3388 is sponsored by Representative Evans. We don't have the paperwork on this bill back today. We don't have any amendments before us today. So House Bill 3388 allows reserve officers to be sponsored by law enforcement units in order to receive training as a police officer. The bill allows reserve officers sponsored by law enforcement units to use cash or other GI Bill education benefits to pay for their training courses, and mandates that the sponsored officers who complete the courses required for training as a police officer be designated as a certified reserve officer and employs them or permits them to be employed as a police officer by any law enforcement unit in Oregon. It also requires that sponsored reserve officers who complete courses required for certification as a police officer to remain with a law enforcement agency for at least 3 years after the date of their certification. The bill requires the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to increase their class size as necessary to train reserve officers sponsored under the bill, but it prohibits an increase greater than 25% as of the effective date. The bill requires DPSST to conduct a study on the impact of its sponsorship program and submit a report to the Legislative Assembly. And the bill contains some sunset clauses both on the sponsorship program and on the study that's associated.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Anderson, you want to come up too? So we're kind of be cramped for time. So please go ahead, Representative.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Evans representing House District 20. Hey, Don. Okay. House District 20, which includes Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and South Salem. I've distributed a letter. Hopefully there's enough. I'm still learning on how many to count on these things. And basically, the bill is exactly as was outlined. It's a pilot program that would allow a form of pay-to-play, which some states have. In other public safety environments, firefighting, for example, many firefighters pay for their education and then they're certified either at the department they're at or in different ways. In the state of Oregon, generally the process is a police officer is hired and then sent, goes to DPSST. DPSST trains the officer, and the city or county usually pays the salary during the training, and then when they come back, they go through a localized training, and then they get upgraded. The focus on this bill is, quite frankly, the following. There are ways to help supplement DPSST training dollars through the use of the GI Bill by folks that I think will want to invest GI Bill dollars in becoming a law enforcement professional. If done right, it could provide the opportunity for reserve officers throughout the state to be kind of a reserve plus option, where they've actually been prepared for full-time employment, but they're waiting for an opportunity to actually get employed as jobs become available. It's also an opportunity to help, in my mind, give some of the vets returning an opportunity to go straight into workforce training, workforce development. We were pretty careful to try to put sideboards on it so it wouldn't cripple the ability to of DPSST to undergo or to continue the program that they currently are doing. That's why we put a maximum of 25%, not a minimum. And in discussions over the years with this particular issue, going back to when I was working for Governor Kulongoski, the number one concern, and I think it was a right concern, is that in some states that allow people to pay their way through police training, if there's no linkage, no oversight and command and control of that person, they could think that they're a police officer but really not be a police officer, and that could create some problems. So in this particular case, people that would be, they'd talk to the city chief or the county sheriff, they'd be sponsored by that senior officer. They'd pay the money either through DPSST or through the city. That needs to be determined. And then once they complete training, they would actually be responsible to maintain a relationship underneath that senior leadership unless they get hired by another law enforcement agency. So there's a protection clause that I think helps, or at least meets the needs that were specified over time. Having said all of that, in the last week, DPSST has come back with kind of a counteroffer. And what the letter suggests is if the chair is interested in what I think Todd is going to mention in a little bit, perhaps we could form a small little work group to talk about it very briefly and see if that option is the way you'd like to go or if this option is the way you'd like to go. The bottom line is we have a lot of folks that have access to the GI Bill that may not be interested in going through other more traditional educational training. We can capture some of those funds to help DPSST do its mission more effectively and I think also help get folks into the job place.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Todd Anderson, the training director at the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. DPSST has a long history of supporting our veterans who attend DPSST in various disciplines, police, corrections, parole and probation, as well as telecommunications. I myself am a proud uncle of a current Marine assigned to Force Recon overseas, and a second Marine who's actually attending our basic police academy now, who was hired as a sheriff's deputy upon his return from his call for service. Currently, through established recruiting processes, many agencies are currently recruiting from all branches of the armed forces as well as the National Guard units, which has brought many of the brightest and brave to the Oregon Public Safety Academy. We remain neutral on H.R. 3388 and our House Bill 3388 and appreciate the intent of the bill. However, a House Bill 3388 as introduced would have a tremendous impact on DPSST's function and operations as detailed in the written testimony. The mission of DPSST is to promote excellence in public safety training by delivering quality training and upholding professional standards for Oregon's public safety providers. DPSST meets this mission by providing training to public safety officers and by certifying officers who meet and maintain the minimum standards found in law enforcement administrative rule. In particular, the concern that DPSST may not have enough basic classes in the 2015-2017 budget cycle. The current waiting period for basic corrections is January of 2016, and if you're a police officer hired as a regular police officer, it's September of this year, 2015, so the waiting period now is at about 5 months. So our concerns are those of getting the full-time officers in there at this time, and we are seeing a significant increase in not what I would call new positions, but attrition hiring. Talking with Chief O'Day from Portland Police Bureau, they have 19 scheduled retirements for May on top of 24 openings. The Oregon State Police could have as many of 150 troopers that are eligible for retirement in this budget cycle. So that being said, we aren't opposed to the bill in its nature, but we would definitely would like to be involved in any further discussions of this bill.
Great. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I look at the bill, one of the questions that I have, and I don't know who's best suited to answer this question, but part of the hiring process for a full-time police officer, deputy sheriff, or trooper is a psychological evaluation. And I think that's a very important piece. And so there's nothing in this bill that suggests to me that that piece would be kept intact to get to the academy. And frankly, that would maybe give me some concerns, because the point of investing this incredible amount of resource and time and energy and the space, I mean, the academy has had more people on the waiting list for years and years. When I went, there was still, and it was it was just a lot different. So my concern is, are we investing these resources in somebody that may or may not be able to be a good fit for law enforcement through the psychological examination process?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, the thing about the GI Bill that was recrafted in 2006 and then updated again in 2010 is that it actually will pay the cost of the highest state tuition of a training program. Inherent to that is the costs associated with the process by which that person can be selected, whatever costs are associated with the psychological test. All of that, at least under the intent of the bill, is something that would be paid for by the GI Bill process and not on the agency. So to my knowledge, they would have to undergo everything that you have to go undergo now to get a full-time job before they even get to the academy. And again, it's sponsored through a chief or a sheriff, and if they say no, it doesn't go beyond that.
That would be something I would really want to have clarified, because that psych exam happens prior to the academy, unless that's changed. It's not part of the academy curriculum. It's the fitness in the hiring process that's evaluated. Is that currently still true?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, a psychological exam is not required by law at this point. Right. However, there are minimum standards for every police officer, including a background and moral fitness standards. And so we would ask that, you know, going forward, if we do form a task force to look at this, that those are some of the things that we talk about and define more.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll probably, I will move the work session over till next week to keep it alive, and then I expect we probably will go to a work session, but we will have a work group take a look at this and try and iron everything out before we proceed further. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
Thank you very much.
The public hearing on House Bill 3388 and reopen House Bill 3233. I'm going to ask, we have a lot of people who want to testify in this, so I'm going to ask people to limit to 3 minutes, their testimony to 3 minutes. I'll call Gail Meyer, Bob Tummel, and Tom Simak. I did all those wrong, but.
You should bring up your client.
That's a wise decision.
I'll sit here. I'll just stand.
No. Just bring up another chair.
Thank you.
Proceed in any order. Remember to identify yourself for the record. Ms. Myers, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Happy to weigh in and lend our support in support of House Bill 3233. In advance of the testimony that you're going to hear from Mr. Thummel here to my right, who is a very experienced DUI practitioner, I want to remind the committee of the 2013 study that was done by TURF, the Traffic Injury Research Foundation. They did an audit of Oregon's DUI laws and ignition interlock laws. And what they continually came back and said was, Oregon's missing the mark when it relies on hard suspension periods, because if you look at it as a form of punishment, then you're sacrificing public safety. They encouraged over and over again, get away from looking at hard suspension periods as a form of punishment for repeat chronic drunk driving. What promotes public safety is to get these people provisional licenses dependent upon having ignition interlock devices on their license privileges. These people will be driving otherwise, and they will be driving uninsured, and that is bad for public safety. So I have previously uploaded onto OLIS that report, but it was in a different bill. So with the chair's permission, I'd like to be able to do it after this hearing and post it, because it is something that could be interesting for the committee. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bob Thummel. I'm a criminal defense lawyer in Oregon, and I have been since 1977. And I would like to thank this group for giving us the chance to come and visit with you about this today. When I started, you'd get a DUII and you'd go see a judge whose name was Beers in Multnomah County, and if it was your first or your 15th, the judge would say things to you like, well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions and I'm the general contractor. And he would fine your client $110 and he would send him home, and that was pretty much the end of that. And that's in my career where we began, and now we're at a place of lifetime driver's license revocations and felony charges, both with two priors and three priors, and I've watched that proceed. This bill is a good idea because I've been defending people across the state in pretty much every county for the last 37 or 8 years. I can't remember how long it's been, but the lifetime revocation is generally the tail that wags the dog in terms of your ability or your desire to fight it in court. I have many clients who have said to me, I would go serve my 90 days cheerfully. In fact, I'd serve 120 if I could just have a way of getting my driver's license back. And I do believe, and I'm sad to say it, but it's true, I think some of those people have probably driven in the face of this revocation, but many of them, good-intentioned people who I think, it is true, many have redeemed themselves, like Representative Kinnamer was talking about, who can do right and change their life because this is the most serious and grave thing that's happened to them yet. So it makes a lot of sense with this policy to give people a chance to get their foot back in the door. I support it. This has a lot of positives. It has a couple of negatives. I know my friend Dina Ryerson will get up and talk about the ignition interlock device program and how it's not ready for this bill yet. That may be. I don't know if it'll ever be ready for any bill, and a bill like this could give that program a little bit of incentive to get ready, because that program is certainly not without its flaws, but I think the fixes to it are out there, and I think Oregon could fix it fast enough. So, really speaking on behalf of those clients across the state who I've seen and talked to in the halls of courtrooms all over this great state that I was born in and raised in and have lived in all my life, I would like this body to consider the passage of this bill. And I, again, appreciate the chance to come visit with you. I see some courtroom friends and adversaries up here, and it's a real treat for me. So thank you very much.
I would read a few quotes from Alice in Wonderland that Judge Beers used to use, but I don't want to make you homesick. So. Please.
Chair Barker, my name is Tom Cermak. I'm the public defender in Marion County. I'm a member of OCDLA, but I'm here today because a couple of weeks ago I got a phone call from Commander Jeff Wood from the Marion County Sheriff's Department. He's the head of the Parole and Probation Division, and he asked me to intervene on with the courts on behalf of the gentleman seated beside me, Mr. Charles Benedict. Mr. Benedict has a checkered and unfortunate history. He began drinking. I don't know when he became an alcoholic, but he began drinking at the age of 7 and began a, and it's not a record, by the way. I once represented a client who started at age 3. But he has been an alcoholic and a criminal for a good many years. In 2004, he received his fifth DUII and went to prison for, I think, 36 months. He was released on post-prison supervision on that case in March of 2007. And unfortunately, the lessons, he had not yet learned his life lesson. He didn't have his epiphany until the next time that he went to prison, when in the middle of his prison sentence, he just determined that he was going to stop drinking. I asked him, for example, what is your sobriety date? And any alcoholic will tell you the last time I took a drink is my sobriety date, except for Mr. Benedict. his sobriety date was the day that he was already in prison, so he hadn't been drinking. But his sobriety date was the day that he decided he would never take another drink, and that was June 15th of 2010. Shortly after that, he got involved in a prison program through the Columbia River Institution, and transitioned from that when he was paroled that time to the SOAR program, which is the Student Opportunity to Achieve Results, which is the litmus test, or the primary case for the Marion County Reentry Initiative. That program took with him. He successfully completed that program in such a way that he impressed both Sheriff Myers and Jeff Woods, who have voiced to me their support for Mr. Benedict. I was asked to help him get his license back. Because the date that he becomes eligible is when he is his post-prison supervision date, he will not be eligible until March of 2017. Department of Motor Vehicles told him they thought it was February of 2015, and when he petitioned the court, he was told that he didn't apply. He would be a gentleman who would be eligible under this program. Since he got out of prison the last time, he has maintained sobriety. Throughout, he is a law-abiding citizen. He completed SOAR. He went to Chemeketa Community College and got a degree in auto body technician, a certification rather. He was told after that he needed to have a driver's license in order to be able to work in that profession. He undaunted, because he knew he wasn't eligible, he works as a welder, has been a tax-paying and law-abiding member of the community since then. This bill would move Mr. and Representative, our Commander Wood, Sheriff Myers, myself, Mr. Benedict, all believe that he would benefit from this bill. That is the last step that will let him regain his dignity and his mobility, be able to pursue the career that he wants and be the family man that he would like to be for his children.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kate Duke and Mark Nicholas, please, and Christy Finney Dunn. In any order, please state your name for the record and try it. We need to be around 3 minutes because we do have long people, so please.
Representative Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kate Duke. I am a board member of the Lane County Chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I am also a volunteer speaker for the Lane Dewey Victim Impact Panel. I'm going to speak just briefly to the ignition interlock device that everybody's been referencing. MAD opposes this bill because it takes our most dangerous offenders, our repeat offenders who have are the most high risk out there, and gives them the opportunity to get behind the wheel of a vehicle. Yes, it has an ignition interlock device component, which would last for 5 years. The problem with that is that there is nobody on the other side of that looks at the reports should that offender reoffend. If they try to drive the vehicle and there is alcohol in their system, the report will have the machine will record a violation, but nobody sees that violation. So there's nobody that looks to see that there is somebody that's trying to reoffend while they're under this program. I'd like to speak today on behalf of myself. I'd like to share a personal story with you about what happens when somebody does get behind the wheel of a car while they're impaired. I was a young mom. I was a mother at the age of 16. I had my son the summer between my sophomore and junior year of high school. I worked 3 jobs. I went to school full time, and I took care of my baby. And I carried a 3.89 grade point average. I had life pretty well under control for somebody who had a fairly large change in the direction of life at a very young age. My senior year in high school, I was engaged to be married. We were planning to be married in August after I graduated. 6 weeks before graduation, my fiancé was hit by a drunk driver and killed. He was killed. He was dead before the paramedics could get to him. He did not die easy. He was on a motorcycle, and the man that hit him was driving a large truck that had a large hood ornament. My fiancé was impaled by that hood ornament. I literally one day was planning a wedding and looking at wedding dresses, and the next day I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to wear to my fiancé's funeral. It takes one crash to change a life forever, to take a life, and that can't be changed. I understand that there is a possibility of redemption, but there's also a possibility of failure, and the risk on the other side of that is catastrophic. Jump ahead 7 years. Mind you, over that 7 years, I suffered severe depression, anxiety. I developed an eating disorder, severe insomnia. I was a wreck. But I did somehow manage to piece myself back together for myself and for my son. After several years, I did finally begin to date again, and I met a wonderful man that we started to try to build a life together. I didn't go to college after my high school because of what had happened. I couldn't cope with that. So it affected my life financially for many, many years because of that. 7 years goes by, and I am on a bicycle with my boyfriend, and we are training for the national short track speed skating event. I had trained for 2 years. I was hit on that bicycle by a drunk driver. My left leg was nearly torn off. My surgeon told me that it is the worst injury he had worked on in over 20 years where he was actually able to save the leg. I went through 4 surgeries and a year of physical therapy. I have pain every day. I have scars. And my 8-year-old son saw me laying in the hospital, and he asked me, "Mommy, are you going to die?" He was incredibly traumatized. I had nearly $100,000 in debt. It all went to collection agencies. The insurance covered parts of it were not covered. I had to file bankruptcy. My financial life was ruined for the next 10 years. I am 45 years old. I am just now going to college. I'm still living the effects of what has happened to me through other people's choices. Rep. Kinnemer was very kind, and he called me a couple of days ago and discussed this bill with me, and I appreciated that very much. But there were a couple of comments that I wanted to address after having time to reflect.
Real quick. Thank you.
He mentioned that drivers that have are eligible for this are only eligible to apply for this if they haven't injured or killed somebody. And my response was that that's just simple chance. His comment back to me was that these are people who have driven impaired over and over and over many times and have never caused a crash that killed or injured anyone, and he has to believe that that's not a coincidence. It's because they have the ability to be more cautious and drive more responsibly impaired than other impaired drivers do that do cause these crashes. And I must say respectfully, I disagree. That makes no sense. There is no such thing as a cautious or responsible impaired driver. Many of these offenders don't wait out their revocation periods. They drive anyway. If they're convicted felons and they're willing to break the law to drive without a license and without insurance, how can we trust that they'll follow the law and not drive impaired? As a citizen, as a mother, as a wife, I'm asking you to vote no on this and do not pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, please, go ahead.
Got the gavel, hit it.
Please.
Hi, my name is Mark Nicholas. I'm a volunteer speaker
on the Lane County Victim DUI Panel. Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present testimony on this important topic. House Bill 3233 authorizes a court to shorten the amount of time that a person's driving privileges are revoked following a felony DUI. I am here today as a private citizen to oppose House Bill 3233. The offenders convicted of felony DUI have established a history of driving while under the influence. They have shown a willingness to blatantly disregard the law and the safety of other people who share the roads with them. It only takes one crash to change someone's life forever. I am living proof of this. As a result of an impaired driver crashing into my vehicle, I flatlined, I thankfully was resuscitated, and then I slipped into a 3.5-week coma. They did not expect me to survive. My brain damage was very severe. I suffered the amputation of my right leg. The bones in my face were crushed. My left eye was severely damaged, leaving me with permanent vision loss in my left eye. I have osteoporosis as a result of the injury to my spine. My right shoulder was broken and the rotary cuff was torn, leaving me with permanent limited mobility on my right arm. I have PTSD, short-term memory loss, due to the traumatic brain injury I suffered. I am no longer to work because of the result of my injuries. My partner John was also involved in this crash. His injuries consisted of a lacerated liver and spleen, broken clavicle bone, right arm twisted 360 degrees, and facial lacerations. The medical costs associated with this crash totaled more than $1.5 million. The emotional cost can never be calculated. Driving is a privilege. Felony DUI drivers have abused that privilege over and over again. They have broken the trust that is given when a license to drive is issued. This bill gives them the chance to drive again without having proper safeguards for public safety. Please consider the lives of the people that may be placed at risk by allowing them to drive. I'm asking you to vote no and do not forward this bill.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today against HB 3233. I'm actually going to deviate from my prepared statement after hearing the testimony.
And you just need to identify yourself.
Excuse me?
You need to state your name for the record.
Oh, Christy Finney Dunn. Sorry. I thought I did say that. My son, my 28-year-old son, Dustin, was killed in Portland in August 2011 by a drunk driver. This drunk driver actually hit Dustin and a second person, and then he drove off. It was a hit and run. One of my staunchest supporters who came down from Seattle immediately after I called him was my brother. My brother is a very, very successful businessman in the Seattle area, and he went to every court date with me. He went to everything. He appeared on TV with me. And he even tried to separate from his wife because of the trauma of what had happened. A year after my son was killed, we had a hike in his honor. And my brother drove down to that hike. And on his way, he got a DUI. And he went to jail. He didn't tell me for 3 months that that had happened. When he did tell me, I yelled at him, and I told him that he never deserves to have his driver's license again, and he told me that he needed his driver's license. But he did remind me that this wasn't his first DUI or his second DUI. This was his 13th DUI. He had already had his driver's license revoked. He had already had time in jail. He had already had an ignition interlock device in his car, and more importantly, he had already lost a nephew to a different drunk driver. I don't even feel like it's the driver part of this. It's the drunk part of this that we need to be careful about. Because the nature of an addict or an alcoholic is that they relapse sometimes. My brother himself said he's fine as long as he doesn't take that first drink. But if he takes that first drink, he can't control anything he does, which is why he was drinking that 13th time that he got caught. I understand rehabilitation. I have spoken about rehabilitation. I have forgiven the young man who killed my son, but I don't want him to drive again. And I don't want my brother to drive again. He doesn't deserve to drive again. He should have had a lesson firmly implanted in his head that this is not an okay behavior to indulge in. I fear for everybody else on the road, and I don't want anybody else, and there are lots of us in this room, to feel the pain and the angst and the horror every time I watch the news and hear of another drunk driver killing someone. So I just have to say that I firmly believe that drunk drivers need more accountability, not less. They need less wiggle room and fewer opportunities to convince themselves that their rights trump the rights of the others on the road. Please do not pass House Bill 3233 because I don't believe it's a good choice for anyone, not even the driver. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, panel. I call Jill Spencer, Jeanette Robart, and Janelle Lawrence, please. Jeanette and Janelle.
Chairman Barker, members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Jill Spencer. On July 24th, 2009, my 16-year-old daughter, Lexi, got into a vehicle with a very impaired driver. She was a junior at Clackamas High School. The driver took the corner in a residential neighborhood at 95 miles an hour, jumped the curb, tore the telephone pole in half, flipping the car and landing in someone's front yard. I was told later this group of boys she was riding with had drunk several times. However, it took this fatality for them to supposedly stop. House Bill 3233 hits me hard. While the boy sat in prison, I decided to do a facilitated dialogue program to speak to him in person and see how he had progressed about his decisions. I believe anyone can change if given the right community around them for support. As our four-hour talking session was ended, I was pleased how everything had gone until he said how upset he was that he cannot have his license when he gets out. It was an inconvenience to him. I lost my daughter, but not having a license is a simple inconvenience. I was beyond upset. When you put an impaired person behind a 5,000-pound car, it's playing Russian roulette. It's not if you're going to kill someone or injure someone, it's when. So imagine my shock and anger when I read House Bill 3233 and saw the proposal that would allow a felon DUI offender someone diversion agreement after the suspensions, after the treatment programs and education, after the counseling, after the ignition interlock devices, after every measure we as society have put in place to help offenders make safer choices, and they have blatantly and repeatedly refused. And now somehow House Bill 3233 that allows the worst of the worst offenders behind the wheel early is magically going to keep us all safe. Maybe it was inconvenient for these felon repeat offenders to drive impaired. Maybe they didn't want to stop partying with their friends and be responsible. Maybe they didn't want to spend money on a taxi. Maybe they didn't want to wait for family or friends to pick them up. Now House Bill 3233 says their families are being inconvenienced because they are stuck driving them around and they want a cheap, easy solution that puts the rest of society in jeopardy. My beautiful daughter, whom I will never see again, became a statistic that day. She was only one of 115 people killed in Oregon that year, in 2009. Until your child dies, or someone dear to you does, maybe you won't get it. It's hard to understand, but making it easier for a repeat drunk driver to get behind the wheel is not the way we should be going. It's no different than letting the offender pull that trigger one more time in Russian roulette. It's not if they kill someone, it's when they will kill someone. The citizens and the victims in Oregon deserve better than House Bill 3233. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeanette Robart. I'm here with Oregon Impact. I also speak with the trauma nurses in Multnomah County. I lost my son Nicholas to a DUI crash March 30th of 2013. The past 2 years have been a horrific cycle of sadness and horror for my family, to the point where my 12-year-old son's screensaver on his phone is still a picture of his brother in his casket. I decided to speak out because of the amount of repeat offenders that I see in my own life that I can't do anything about, even with the amount of times I call the police on them to get them arrested. It doesn't do any good. So giving their license back to them seems kind of senseless to me. My eyes were opened about 5 months after my son died when my ex tried to drive out of our driveway drunk. Mind you, this is after a completed diversion program that he completed. He snowed his way through. He got out. The day he was done, he was back at the bar and drove home. I have continued to be horrified watching the kids that were there. Mind you, there were about 50 kids with my son the night he died, 7 of them in the vehicle. Today, I can say that all of the kids that were in the vehicle with him, minus the driver who was in prison for 5 years, are back to drinking and driving and doing the exact same things because they did not learn their lesson, because they didn't have a penalty, because they know that they can just get away with whatever is going to happen. I also listened to, at a family function, a couple weeks ago before I walked out and my family knew I was there, listened to a bunch of my cousins stand around talking about how they didn't remember getting home from the Copper Penny after they went dancing at the nightclub. But then the minute I walk out the door, it's, oh, we feel so bad. You know, like, these are the things that I see over and over and over. These are the people that shouldn't be driving. These are the people that should not be on the roads anymore. And I've personally watched people snow the system over and over and over again. So how is a judge that's not in this person's life every day going to be able to know how they've progressed? It's too late for me, but it's not too late for others. While I'm a huge advocate for second chances, to the point where the driver of that vehicle that my son died in was my son's best friend, also the person that held my son until his eyes went dead, knows that when he gets out, when he needs a ride somewhere, he can call Mama anytime, because I'll take him. But he's not going to drive again, because he doesn't deserve to. If people aren't learning from their decisions, then it's time for the law and for us as citizens to step up and protect us from this pain. These people that are repeatedly going to diversions that our state is offering and pretending to learn from their lessons are dangerous and, in my eyes, lack value for human life. House Bill 3233 will be continually putting my family, your families, and other innocent people in danger, and it's not fair. It is time that we as a community stand up and start fighting to protect our families from this pain. It is time that these repeat offenders be held accountable for their decisions, not mistakes. We deserve to have laws that protect us from these dangerous people that don't value our lives.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
My name is Janelle Lawrence. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Impact. We administer the DUI Victims Impact Panel for Clackamas County. We provide education to schools and the community around impaired and distracted driving. And we provide hundreds of thousands of dollars each year for police agencies across Oregon to hold DUI high visibility enforcement details to keep impaired drivers off the road. And I'd like to share with you my opposition for the passage of House Bill 3233. As you know, this bill modifies current law pertaining to a person convicted of a felony driving under the influence of intoxicants and who has been convicted of four or more offenses. Current law requires a 10-year license revocation before a person is eligible to have their license reinstated. Passage of this bill would reduce that period to only 5 years if the offender agrees to get an interlock device. It really puts the worst of the worst of the worst offenders back behind the wheel, those with multiple DUIs, failed opportunities with diversion, treatment, and suspensions. Now, the interlock devices are a powerful tool, but we don't have an infrastructure in place to monitor offenders' compliance and keep them accountable, especially when they're not on a court-ordered diversion. Further, Oregon's justice system already accommodates for second chances and third chances and beyond. But at some point, offenders who have consistently demonstrated their lack of regard for public safety need to be held accountable. This bill does more to enable dangerous, life-threatening behavior than it does to incentivize responsible behavior as in a diversion program. Lastly, a DUI felon, regardless of addiction and substance abuse issues, has clearly demonstrated a lack of regard for public safety and ignored multiple chances to address the causes. Just because a fatal crash hasn't happened is no reason to assume it will not or cannot. All of us here have something in common besides being Oregonians. We all have someone on the roadway who is precious to us. We can't afford to gamble with the safety of innocent drivers, passengers, bicyclists, and pedestrians. Please don't pass Bill 3233.
Thank you very much for your testimony, panel. Chuck Hayes, Dan Norris, and Connie Cabrera. Still have a lot to go today, so
yes, sir.
Appreciate it.
All right. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Williamson and Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Hayes, and I'm the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and I'm here today also in opposition of this bill, 3233, representing our committee as well. My background, other than the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, 30-plus years in law enforcement, 30 of those years with the Oregon State Police. And I can tell you, nothing more frustrating in our job as police officers is to encounter someone that is a repeat offender, that has just continued to get themselves in trouble, commit the offense of DUI, and then we're arresting these people, and then actually sometimes arresting the same person over and over and over again. And then my 30 years, I can remember that happening so many times, and it was so frustrating. Also, to go up to a crash scene when you've got someone that is severely injured or maybe someone who is deceased, and then also to encounter someone who is a repeat offender that is the cause of that crash. There was times in my career that I just asked the person, it's like, didn't you go through treatment? Well, yes, I did. Well, what happened? And it's just, you know, one excuse after another, so very frustrating. And I can tell you that here in Oregon, we have made some great advances here in the last decade of reducing alcohol-involved fatalities. We're one of the best in the country now, averaging just about 101 fatalities per year. But still, that's 101 people that should have never died. And so we really have to work hard to maintain safety on our highways and to keep these people off our highways. So I know you've heard some testimony today, and I'm not going to repeat a lot of that, but one of the things that just jumped out at me is that we're weighing heavily on a system here that sometimes the system is not working very well. And so it's a great list that has been put together by the representative on this bill, but yet we're putting a lot of pressure on somebody to make some decisions here that so far don't seem to be always working. When we encounter people that have violated this treatment, you've heard testimony about diversion not working, about ignition interlocks not working, and I can tell you that we do have an ignition interlock law in this state. It's not broken, but it needs to be fixed. And so we need to make sure that we have those safeguards in first, in my opinion, before we start looking at things like this. There's some things that have got to be done. And then if we can get those in place, well, then maybe we can look at things like this. So let's please keep that into consideration. So until that happens, our committee, we oppose this bill, and we ask that you vote not in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County, Oregon, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Being from a rural county, I don't disagree with what Ms. Myers and some of the proponents of the bill say. Having a license and having insurance are very, very important. The problem with the bill as it exists right now is we have a system that doesn't work in relation to interlocks. Mr. Mannix and some of the proponents ask you to pass the bill and then fix the interlock problems. Right now, if someone's not on probation, that interlock report showing a failure is going to go to a black hole in the Department of Motor Vehicles, and no one is going to know that that person needs their license taken away. I think we all believe in rehabilitation, especially in my association. We play Russian roulette on a daily basis with downward departures as to who we can safely keep in our community and who we can't. We understand the cost benefits, but until the interlock issue is solved, this is a game of Russian roulette that just can't be played. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Connie Cabrera, and I'm coming to you on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I have testified in front of this committee before, and you're aware of my background on the issues surrounding impaired driving. I am both a DUII offender and a victim. June 21st, 1998, I lost my 16-year-old daughter to a drunk driver. And I've also had two DUIs myself, gone through diversion and the conviction process, and also had a near-fatal accident where I was about 15 minutes away from losing my life. You will likely hear from many experts in their field on these bills, law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and other organizations. But my experiences have put me closer to this issue than anyone could ever want to be, and more than I would ever want anyone to be. I'm also a volunteer speaker for Marion, Clackamas, and Yamhill County's victim impact panels. I'm speaking today to oppose HB 3233. This bill allows a felony DUII offender who has received a lifetime license revocation, essentially meaning a minimum of 10 years before the offender can apply for a hardship permit, to apply after only 5 years if an interlock ignition device is installed. The GAC DUII strongly supports ignition interlock devices as a means of keeping offenders accountable, especially to support an offender when going through substance abuse treatment as they would after their first offense with a diversion agreement. However, the GAC DUII also recognizes that after four DUI offenses, as would be the case with HB 3233, the offender has had multiple opportunities for treatment. IIDs, diversion, hardship permits, suspensions, jail times, and other incentives available to make safe, responsible choices on the road. HB 3233 just enables the felony repeat offender to continue to make those same reckless, irresponsible choices sooner, putting themselves and everyone else at risk. IIDs are an effective tool. However, Oregon's interlock system is a patchwork of good intentions but lacking in cohesive coordination. Oregon's system lacks the necessary safeguard of established communication between the IID providers, the courts, and other professionals in the DUII continuum, in particular during the assignment of an IID with a conviction. There is simply no framework for any oversight authority on convictions to receive or share information pertaining to a negative IID report of tampering, unauthorized removal, or worst of all, attempts to start the vehicle with a detectable blood alcohol content. A felony offender under HB 3233 could apply for a hardship permit, install the IID, and spend the next 5 years violating the spirit of the interlock with absolutely no accountability or oversight. Several bills this session and administrative rules are making some of those first changes needed for cohesiveness, but there is much work to be done. Passing HB 3233 would tragically prematurely and put the very worst DUII recidivists, a small fraction of the bulk of DUII cases annually, back behind the wheel with no oversight. The risk is too much and the cost is too high. On behalf of the GAC on DUII, I respectfully request the House Judiciary Committee to not pass HB 3233. Thank you for your time. Thank you very much, panel.
Appreciate your testimony. I think I have two more people, Dina Ryerson and Joy John Scharf. And we are pressed for time, so I appreciate brevity if we can get it through. Please go ahead.
My name is John Lloyd Scharf. I live here locally. I am the rehabilitated, reformed drunk driver. I was stopped probably a dozen times before I ever got cited for DUII. I am surprised at the wording of a thing that says this is a lifetime. It's not, and then it's not a lifetime revocation. It's bizarre. I know that the energy involved in a vehicle is the same as a 20-millimeter gun if you are going 45 miles an hour. If I did one time shot around through town like that, pretty sure that would be the end of it. I'm never going to own a firearm again. Yet we keep bringing this back. I don't understand it. I'm confused. Why is this even on the docket? Why are you doing this? That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Barker, members of the committee. My name is Dina Ryerson. I work for the Department of Justice. I'm not going to spend time reiterating some of the concerns. Gail Meyer was correct that there was a TURF report done that analyzed the entire ignition interlock system in Oregon, and there was a very big discussion on trying to reduce hard suspensions. But what she didn't mention was the biggest part of the TURF report was to completely revamp and restructure the ignition interlock system. So I encourage the members of the committee to read it. And the main point is to provide that safety net with the ignition interlock system to know when offenders are either tampering with the device, continuing to attempt to drink and drive, and there's no supervision for the repeat offenders trying to get their license back where those reports, they have no place to go. The other big part that no one has mentioned is those who offend under the influence of drugs, which is just on the increase, and as with Measure 91 passing will just continue to increase. Ignition interlocks do not protect the public against those who drive under the influence of drugs. So that's a concern when passing a bill such as this, to have that in place as a safety net for those who drive under the influence of drugs. The one other concern, and then I'm finished with my testimony, is that there's been a discussion on the fact that these people will not have previously injured. But the way the bill is actually, the Dash 1 amendments, the way they're worded, is that the DUI that you get the license revocation for, the permanent, and I put permanent in air quotes because you couldn't be eligible for 10 years, that's the one that you cannot have committed or cannot involve an injury. So for the potential diversion, the first conviction, and the second conviction, those can involve injuries. It's only the third one that gives you the permanent revocation that would not be something that you can have an injury to be eligible for this. So it's a problem to say that these people who would be eligible would never have been involved in a situation where they injured somebody, because that they can, actually. So that being said, that's all my testimony, if anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much. I've polled the committee. There is not support for the bill today. Representative Olson has told me he wants to head up a work group to work on the ID question to try to get that straightened out. That seems to be a major stumbling block to this, to moving this bill forward. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3233. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2230. I'm sorry, 2320.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2320 comes to this committee from the House Interim Judicial Committee. The bill decreases the classification of the crime of cheating from a C felony to an A misdemeanor. There are four amendments before the committee. The proposed -1 amendment replaces the measure. It modifies a provision of expungement specifically related to Class C felony sex offenses. Currently, there's a provision where under ORS 181.830 where a defendant can seek an expungement if a host of factors are met, including the person has been relieved of their sex offender registration obligation, the person was under 16 at the time of the offense, and the person and the victim were within 3 years of age at the time of the offense. This amendment extends that age difference from 3 years to 3.5 years. The proposed -2 amendment before the committee also completely replaces the measure. It is, by and large, a host of fixes to House Bill 2549 of the 2013 legislative session. Mr. Lovejoy is here from the Department of Justice to explain it to the committee, and so I will let him rather than me, because it is rather lengthy. The proposed -3 amendment also completely replaces the measure. It eliminates the automatic reporting requirement for juveniles who are adjudicated for felony sex offenses. It establishes a procedure whereby within 30 days of the juvenile being released from supervision or custody, the court will hold a hearing to determine if the juvenile shall register going forward. The youth at that hearing would have the burden of proof by proving by clear and convincing evidence that they are rehabilitated and do not pose a threat to public safety. The proposed -4 amendment incorporates all three amendments. We do have the fiscal paperwork in. We would need to add this to a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay. Yes. I have the list right here. Okay. I'm sorry.
If you call it, just go ahead and call it from there.
We need Mr. Lovejoy and Mark McKechnie.
Before I give that to the chair.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Herbert Lovejoy. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also the Assistant Attorney in charge of the Government Services Section of the General Counsel Division of the Department of Justice. That section provides legal services to the Oregon Youth Authority, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Department of Corrections, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and the Board of Parole Post-Prison Supervision. I'm going to be addressing the -2 amendments, which those five state agencies are bringing forward today. I will explain what's contained in the -2s. They are lengthy. There's 53 pages of them. And what the changes are, and then the representatives from the various five stakeholder agencies are available to answer any questions related to why the changes are necessary. Before I begin, I do want to put on the record that I'm here in my capacity as legal advisor to those five agencies. I am not here to advance any policy directive from the Oregon Department of Justice or to weigh in favor or against any of the proposed amendments in the -2 amendments. What I propose to do today is go through the various what I'll call policy options that are being advanced by the five stakeholder agencies and where they're contained in the -2 amendments and what those policy options are for the committee's review. The first one is and I apologize if I start bouncing around within the -2 amendment sections, but they're kind of scattered. So the first summary of policy option one, that will authorize the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the Oregon Health or the Oregon Health Authority, instead of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, to conduct risk assessments for adult offenders with judgments for guilty except for insanity, where the offender is on conditional release under the Psychiatric Security Review Board or OHA, is discharged from their various jurisdictions or placed on conditional discharge by the court. That policy option also requires the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the Oregon Health Authority to notify the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision within 7 days when an adult offender is conditionally released or discharged from their jurisdiction and the offender has a prior adult sex crime conviction, requiring the offender to report. It also requires the PSRB and the OHA to report assessments to the Oregon State Police for entry into LEDs. And it also authorizes the PSRB to conduct risk assessment of assessments on adult offenders who are in their jurisdiction because of a judgment for guilty except for insanity, but they also have an attendant qualifying sex crime conviction for which normally the PSRB or the Board of Parole would be doing the assessment if the PSRB has the financial means and staffing to make that assessment. They'd be doing it already on the guilty except for insanity side, so they'd also be able to do it because the person has a qualifying sex offender conviction. Lastly, policy option one requires information sharing between the PSRB, the OHA, and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision for the purposes of sex offender risk assessment and classification purposes. As this committee is aware, the legislature significantly revamped sex offender registration in 2013 under House Bill 2549 and opted for a leveling system 1, 2, and 3 based on risk assessment for reoffending. These provisions are aimed at streamlining the process between the agencies and allowing the agencies who have jurisdiction of the particular offenders to do the assessments rather than centralizing it in a particular agency. Policy option one, these amendments to the existing sex offender registration statutes are in sections 19, 20, 21, 27, and 2 of the Dash 2 amendments. 19, 20, 21 are the information sharing provisions. Section 2 is the notification to the Board of Parole from PSRB and OHA within 7 days. And Section 27 is the authorization for PSRB to do assessment for classifications of offenders in their custodies, in their various custodies, and to also do the assessment on adult offenders with adult convictions that are also in their jurisdiction if they have resources. The second policy option that's contained in the Dash 2 amendments, It changes the risk assessment language that's currently in statute under ORS 181800 from a tool to a methodology. And again, the agencies are here to explain why that's necessary based on varying methodologies that can be used for adult male offenders versus female offenders versus juvenile offenders. So it kind of allows multiple methodologies to be used. It also requires the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision instead of the Oregon Department of Corrections to adopt the methodology by rule in consultation with community correction agencies. It transfers the assessment, review of the assessment score objections and final classification for offenders incarcerated under ORS 163355 to 163427. So that's the major sex crimes from Department of Corrections to the Board of Post-Prison Supervision and makes that transfer retroactive to January 1 of 2014. That's the effective date of House Bill 2549. It also repeals the statutory provisions regarding the designation of juvenile sex offenders as predatory and also amends some the criminal statutes to remove the attendant statutory references to the juvenile predatory sex offenders. Those amendments are contained in sections 1, 2, 4, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 31 of the Dash 2 amendments.
Chair Barker.
Yes, sir.
Can I kind of interrupt for
you? Yes, you can.
Just to clarify for the members of the committee, the Dash 4s are in front of you. they incorporate the dash two. So the section numbers here referring to are the same, and the page numbers are the same. The dash threes and the dash fours are added after the dash two. So when it says dash four at the top, he is referencing the documents that you have in front of you.
Thank you.
I only had time to review the dash twos. I apologize.
The first 53 pages of the dash four are the dash twos he's speaking of.
The last 21 pages are different.
Yeah.
Okay. There are also conforming amendments on sections 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26 that affect the same policy option number two. The third policy option for the committee's review is the removal of the automatic designation as level three sex offenders. Currently, under House Bill 20, the language that's been enacted under House Bill 2549, any offender who is required to first report as a sex offender on or after January 1 of 2014 is automatically declared a level three sex offender until the assessment occurs and classifies them as a level one or two. In addition, for existing registrants being offenders who are first required to register as a sex offender prior to January 1 of 2014, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is required to conduct a assessment of those offenders and classify them as a level one, two, or three. And currently, the deadline for doing that is December 1 of 2016. If the board fails to make such a an assessment and classification, then those existing registrants on or after December 1 of 2016 would be automatically declared a level three sex offender. The reason for the removal of the automatic designation, the legal reason, is that there's a concern under Norris versus Board of Parole, which is a 1998 case, that the equation of level three sex offenders is what we used to do prior to January 1 of 2014 with predatory adult sex offenders, which is to post them on the website. As most of the committee members know, once something goes out on the website, it's almost impossible to get it back. In addition, under the tiering system, it's fairly evident legally that the majority of the sex offenders, both existing registrants and offenders on or after January 1 of 2014, will not be level threes. They'll be level ones and twos, which will not go on the website. And so even though the Norris versus Board of Parole decision involved a subjective standard for designating someone as a predatory sex offender, there is a significant risk because of the possibility of an erroneous deprivation of a liberty interest, specifically because you're posting someone on a level three as a level three to the website when, in fact, they're probably not going to be a level three. They're going to be a level one or two. That could raise a procedural due process problem such that they would be entitled to a pre-deprivation hearing. And so removal of the automatic designation would take care of that issue and avoid the procedural due process problem that's under Norris versus Board of Parole. Those deletions of automatic level three designation is contained in sections 3 and section 27 of the dash 2 and now the dash 4 amendments. Policy option 4, this allows the Oregon State Police to continue to post adult sex offenders that were formerly designated as predatory sex offenders on the sex offender registration website, which is internet notification for the community, through what is currently December 1 of 2016. That's the date that the Board of Parole has to complete classification of the existing registrants under level 1, 2, or 3. Those changes are contained in sections 11 and section 27 of the amendments. Policy option number 5 amends ORS 181.820, which is the existing relief from registration statutes that exists through December 31st of 2016, and that corresponds with one of the previous policy directives to remove juvenile predatory sex offenders from the ability to seek relief from registration under that statute. It would basically shunt juveniles and adults into 181.821 on or after December 31st of 2016. That amendment is contained in Section 12 of the amendments. Policy option number 6 corrects a technical issue with four statutes. This is the and the big ones are the criminal statutes under ORS 163-476 and 163-479. Those are the criminal provisions that make it a crime for a particular group of sex offenders to either go to a school where children are present or to congregate where children are at. What happened with House Bill 2549 is that on or after January 1 of 2014, the adult predatory sex offender language went away. It was deleted from those statutes. And in its place, the juvenile predatory sex offender language was inserted. Also inserted was level 3 offenders. So on or after January 1 of 2014, and until the board classifies offenders that were previously designated prior to 1-1 of 2014 as adult predatory offenders are no longer subject to those criminal prohibitions. And just to notify the committee, there is real-life examples. We have had two adult male predatory sex offenders, one in Josephine County and one in Linn County, who were previously designated as predatory prior to January 1 of 2014 and after January 1 of 2014 have alleged to have violated both the prohibition of going to a school where children are present or going to a place where children congregate. Criminal charges were alleged against them, but the prosecution had to dismiss them because their status as a previously designated adult predatory sex offender is not part of the prohibitions that would result in criminal liability under those statutes. So it's happening in real time as far as that change occurring. And those changes are sections 15 through 18, and then there are conforming amendments in sections 22 through 26. Basically, what the changes in the amendments do is for the interim period from January, from the date that this is adopted until the board reclassifies all of the existing registrants, if there is an adult offender who was previously designated as a predatory sex offender, that would be put back into the prohibitions in those criminal statutes and prohibit them criminally from going to places where children congregate or schools. And then the conforming amendments, when that date is met for the board to have completed its assessment of the existing registrants, that language would then be deleted because it's no longer necessary, because all of the existing registrants would then be reclassified as either 1, 2, or 3 under the new tiering system. Policy option number 7 creates an exception for the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the Oregon Health Authority. Again, level 3 sex offenders are required to be posted on the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration website. This change would exempt out from that notification on the website provision for level 3 offenders under PSRB jurisdiction or under OHA jurisdiction while they are being supervised. So while they're under the supervision of those two entities and they're level 3s, they would not be posted on the website. Once the supervision ends for those agencies and they remain level 3s, then they would be put onto the website. Policy option number 8. And that is contained in section 13 of your amendments. Policy option number 8 amends the ORS 181-801 subsection 5 to require any agency that classifies a sex offender as a level 1, 2, or 3 to notify the Oregon Department of State Police of the final classification within 3 business days so that the Oregon State Police can put that into LEDS and notify law enforcement community. That change is also contained in Section 2 of the amendments. Policy Option 9 allows the Oregon Youth Authority to register youth offenders that are committed to the Oregon Youth Authority by order of a juvenile court, and also persons placed in the physical custody of the Youth Authority under 137-124. And it also allows the juvenile juvenile departments to do the same thing. Back in 2011, the legislature in Senate Bill 408, and that bill became effective on January 11th of 2011, deleted out the supervising agency's authority to register offenders that are under their supervision. And so this would add back in just OYA and the juvenile departments to allow them to register the juvenile offenders or the DOC offenders that go to OYA that are under their supervision. Those amendments are contained in sections 5 through 10 of your amendments. There's also a conforming amendment in section 30 of the amendments. Last but not least, the policy option 10, I said that the board has until December 1 of 2016 to get all of the existing registrants classified under the level 1, 2, or 3. What option 10 will do is extend that date for 2 years to give them time to basically there's, I think, 25,000 existing registrants, and it's going to be a workload issue that I understand that the board is going to be asking for that 2-year extension in order for them to get the existing registrants classified under levels 1, 2, and 3. So it extends it from December 1 of 2016 to December 1 of 2018. Those changes are contained in sections 27, 28, and 29 of your amendments.
Thank you. That was great. Colleagues, I'm sure you got all of that down. I wanted to do just a quick translation. In the 2013 session, we revamped the sex offender registry based on a theory that using risk tools, we could do a better job of figuring out what level of risk a sex offender on the registry actually posed. And so this bill is a result of all of the agencies who have a part in that process getting together and figuring out how to make the law that we passed work. And so these are the changes from those agencies that got together and said, we need to, it actually doesn't work that way, or we need to, you know, it needs to be in DOC, not OYA. And so this is the result of a lot of really, really hard work by a lot of agency folks who are sitting out there. So thank you very much for doing that. And it did become apparent that the workload that we asked the parole board to do around assessing, ensuring that every sex offender in Oregon had a risk assessment, will take an additional 2 years because there's a lot of work there. And so we gave the board a pretty unrealistic deadline in our 2013 bill. So.
Yes, may I ask a question? Are there policy changes in here? Or are they basically technical and administrative changes?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, some of this does contain technical changes. Some of this does modify some of the policy decisions that were made under House Bill 2549. For example, the policy decision to create predatory juvenile sex offenders, that was part of the legislative policy decision making back in 2013. This would delete that. So there are some and
1 second. Yeah. That was actually not a policy decision.
Okay.
That was a mistake. And so the board came to us and said, you just created predatory child sex offenders or juvenile sex offenders. And we said that was actually not something we meant to do. So okay. I just want to make sure for the record, we did not mean to make that policy choice and we are fixing it.
Okay.
But generally, are there other policy choices, or,
I would look to the agencies who worked through this to see where there were significant policy changes. It was my understanding that there really weren't, that the changes made were about how to make
our bail work from last session. So if there's anyone from any agency.
Well, if you can go through the 13 again, that would be good. I'm just kidding.
EOC and the board all shaking their heads. So that was not the intent, okay. Is to change policy.
It sounded like that, but I really
yeah.
Hey, Sherry? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it, buddy. are we moving this amendment today? Is it your intent to move the amendment?
It is my intent to move it, yeah.
Just so you know, it's probably just fine. I'm not going to support moving it today just because I've not waded through this 53-page amendment. And I, as much as I appreciate that, I don't have a comfort level to do that.
74 pages.
Yeah.
Chair Barker, so just going back to 2013, it becomes a political football whenever we do a policy lift of that nature. However, every single person, I think, agrees that a multi-tier system is superior in terms of what it's actually trying to achieve than the binary system. Oregon was an early adopter. Like most early states, we had that binary system. You're either on the registry or you're not. Later states improved that model and had that multi-tier system. We tried to shift it from a binary. We did shift it from a binary to a multi-tier system. I think we all knew that a bill of this nature would be necessary this term because despite our very best efforts, we couldn't get it exactly right that first time. But this bill is necessary, I think, to really make it work. I voted for the last one. I'm happy to vote for this one.
Thank you, Representative Krieger.
I can ask any member of this committee 5 questions. I'll bet you $100 for every question you can answer it out of this bill. We haven't had time to digest this thing. I don't know what's in it. I don't know. Did you work with the agencies? I never even knew it was going on.
The governor's office pulled the agencies together.
You know, I think we should have been involved. I think we should have been aware of it. It was a bill that came from legislators that had worked on this for several years. I don't much appreciate it.
Okay, what I'm going to do, hearing those points, is I'm going to close the hearing on this right now. We'll move it to Monday.
Good.
And have a chance, so everybody has a chance to look this over.
Maybe I'll feel better Monday.
And Chair Barker?
Yes.
Could we also move 2902 to Monday?
2902 is moved to Monday as well. Jesus. Okay, so next one.
This is the unfortunate. Oh, that's right. Thanks for coming, I guess.
You're not going to be down here Monday next soon. We'd be pretty crowded Monday.
I could be. I was going to be. I can be brief.
Okay.
It actually relates to 2 bills.
Okay. So a reopening briefly so Mr. McKechnie can, since he's here and ready to go, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I will try to be as brief as possible. And this, I'll note for the record, my testimony applies both to House Bill 2902 and House Bill 2320. You heard.
State your name.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Mark McKechnie, Youth Rights and Justice. You heard about 2 months ago, I believe, testimony on House Bill 2902, which would modify the juvenile sex offender registry. And in spite of the discussion that preceded this, the juvenile registry operates much differently and does not fall under the tiering system because juveniles simply can't be assessed in the same way. So I wanted to briefly explain the effect of the -3 and the -4 amendments to 2320 and the -3 amendments to 2902. And we're mostly happy with them. What they do is that they would remove the automatic registration requirement at the beginning of juvenile court jurisdiction when a youth is adjudicated. And they would require a hearing within 6 months of the end of juvenile court jurisdiction when a judge would consider the youth's risk to reoffend. And if the youth established by clear and convincing evidence that they were not a risk to reoffend or a risk to the community, the judge would relieve the youth of that requirement to register. This is a substantial improvement over the current law. which applies automatic registration to all youth without any individual decision-making by the court. And as a result, we have one of the highest rates per capita of youth in the country who are required to register, about 3,000. I did want to note two concerns about the amendments, the dash threes and fours of 2320 and the dash threes of 2902. The first is more technical in that there's a reference to the youth filing a petition to avoid the registration requirement, but there wasn't a preceding section that talked about the how, the when, and the where the youth was expected to file the petition. So we may need to clean that up at some point in the process. I understand it may not be in this committee, but I wanted to put that on the record. The second concern is more substantive, and if you're looking at the dash four amendments to 2320, it comes on pages 46 and 47 and 48, and specifically on page 48, subsection 5, the statute as amended would require the court to consider all available polygraph examination preparation materials and examination reports. We're concerned that polygraph examinations are not currently admissible in court, and requiring the court to consider evidence or information that's not admissible in other types of proceedings, we have a lot of concerns about, particularly with youth. Hopefully you're aware that polygraphs measure physiological responses that are used to indicate whether somebody is being truthful or deceptive. And with youth, they can, I think, be even more questionable in terms of the results and what they indicate. The demeanor of an adult examiner can have an effect on the youth's physiological and emotional response. Youth who have a developmental disability or mental illness, such as anxiety disorder, obviously their physiological response can be affected by their disability rather than the truthfulness of their statements. And I've heard examples in particular in the first hearing on this issue. We specifically talked about the fact that about a third of juvenile offenders had themselves been sexually abused prior to their offending, and asking questions about their sexual history and sexual abuse in a polygraph can be also very emotionally charged and cause essentially false positives or inconclusive results from a polygraph. And for those and other reasons, and the general inadmissibility of this kind of evidence in other kinds of cases, we would strongly prefer that subsection 5 be removed from this legislation. And I also wanted to note finally that obviously you're looking at the dash 4 versions of the amendments for 2320. I wanted to highlight the fact that one additional piece that is in the dash fours that is not in the dash threes, and fortunately doesn't sound like you're considering the dash threes, comes in section 35, and it's simply a technical fix to conform the juvenile relief statute with the adult relief statute in terms of where someone can file a petition for relief. Several sessions ago, the adult statute was amended so that even someone who moved out of Oregon, who was required to register originally in Oregon, if they were an adult offender who was eligible, they could apply in Oregon. Currently, and I have no idea why this is the case, the juvenile statute doesn't allow that. So we hear from youth who have moved to Washington, California, other states. They would like to apply for relief. They would be eligible if they were residing, working, or going to school in Oregon to apply for relief. But because they're not residing, working, or going to school in Oregon at the time, they're not permitted under the current statute to apply for relief. This change in Section 35 simply allows them to apply in the court where they were, the county where they were adjudicated, even if they're residing out of state, and we believe it's a technical fix, and we've heard no opposition to making that particular change.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say, I took a look at, we spoke briefly in the hallway about the polygraph. I don't like polygraphs that it's going to do guilt or innocence. These are the ones where they're asking the person, have you done this, you know, have you done more there, which we're moving from taking all these juveniles who had to register for life out of that. I think that's still an important piece, and for once in my life, I'm going to say I would trust the judges that handle these cases are skilled jurists, and I would trust them to weigh that information appropriately. And I'm very reluctant to want to take that out of there. I think that still needs to be in there so that the courts have a full view of the person they're dealing with, and I think that would be helpful for them to have that information. But that with
Can I just make one comment, Chair Barker? I think really for us it's a difference. We believe that information will come in through the treatment providers, but in a context of where they, a professional who's worked closely with the youth over often a period of months or years, is providing information in a greater context, in the clinical context. And we feel that's a more appropriate way for that information to be presented to the court rather than turning over records and letting the court try to figure it out. The other concern, as you know, there's been extensive work done on the confidentiality of juvenile records, and by requiring this particular information to be put into the record, we're concerned that some information that normally wouldn't be in a court record would get in through this subsection 5. So we understand it's probably not going to be changed in this committee, but I wanted to put those concerns on the record.
I appreciate you putting that on the record. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll close those hearings. Open a hearing on House Bill 2367.
The Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2367 is also a bill from the Interim Committee. We heard this bill on March 26th. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact, and so it would need to be referred. It already has a referral to Ways and Means. I apologize. The bill establishes a task force on studying collateral consequences of criminal convictions. It also creates provisions whereby a youth in a juvenile adjudication or an adult in a criminal prosecution would be advised of certain consequences at the time of the arraignment and at the time of the plea. The Dash 3 amendment sunsets those substantive provisions that would require court notification until January 1st, 2018, and it authorizes a task force to study the positions in the meantime.
Okay.
Chair Barker, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2367.
President Williamson moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2367. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2367 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2367 as amended to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And committee, I'll ask if we can stay. If you can stay, I'd appreciate it. We're trying to get through some of these bills. And I would also say for Monday, we have a potential to run late. So if we could plan to run late that day, I'll try to get done by 5. But if we,
Mr. Chair, I have a schedule in my committee at 7 on Monday.
Okay, I hope we're done way before that.
All night Monday, but not tonight.
Okay, thank you. Okay, open a. Is that a work session? Public hearing on House Bill 2936.
2936 is being rolled over to Monday.
Okay, I'm sorry, rolled over. Okay.
What about 2324? Did you?
We are not hearing that.
2324 isn't ready to do anything.
It's not going
to
be open.
It's not going to be open.
Ready on 3093.
3093. Work session, open a work session on House Bill 3093.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3093 provides that persons licensed to carry a concealed handgun in another state will have the same protections afforded to persons with an Oregon concealed carry permit, providing the issuing state license requirements are no less stringent than the Oregon requirements. The bill as introduced directs the Department of State Police to compile a list of eligible states and make the list available to law enforcement and the public. We are considering the Dash 2 amendments today, which direct the Department of Justice to compile the list in lieu of the Department of State Police. They enumerate specific requirements for reciprocity and state that the home state must recognize the Oregon concealed carry permit, thus creating a full reciprocity. This bill has a minimal impact and a no revenue impact, and we are ready to move it today.
Thank you.
No revenue impact on the amendment?
No revenue impact on the amendment, correct.
Do it free, good.
I'm sorry?
I say DOJ has been doing it smart without mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, ready?
Ready, I am indeed.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3093.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 2 amendment into House Bill 3093. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3093 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 3093 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Post, would you please carry that for us? Thank you.
2980.
Open a work session of House Bill 2980.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2980 authorizes a defendant to request a district attorney to approve an extension of a stay of criminal proceedings and a district attorney diversion. It requires the court to grant an extension upon the district attorney approval. We are considering the proposed Dash 1 amendments today, which eliminate a 30-day time requirement for the defendant's request. They allow the defendant to request an extension after a district attorney's request for termination. We have a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. We are ready to move the bill with the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2980.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2980. Discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2980 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry the bill. Next.
What's it for me?
They're open a works. Oh, I had to show that rolling over. Oh, actually, we're not. 3170 is going to die.
Okay.
Which one's the next one? 3452. Open a work session of House Bill 3452.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3452 is sponsored by Representative Widener, along with Representatives Johnson, McLean, Nierman, Smith, Stark, and Wisnett. We previously had a public hearing on this bill on April 14th, at which time we talked about the proposed Dash 1 amendment. So House Bill 3452 prohibits indemnification by contract of the owner of a property or facilities used by a nonprofit organization providing services to youths for damages not caused by an individual participant. The proposed Dash 1 amendment expands application to include educational providers in addition to nonprofit organizations providing services to youths. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. It is ready to move.
We need Dash 1s on that.
Yep, we did.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3452.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3452. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3452 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 3452 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I'd like to have one of my good lawyers carry that.
I think Representative McLean might like to do it.
Oh, McLean. Have Representative McLean be the carrier. Thank you.
Though Representative Widener could be entertaining.
Yeah. No, he can't. we're going to roll House Bill 3498 over till Monday.
That's it.
Anything else?
3233, are we going to be rolling that over, or do we want to hear that again? Rep. Kenemer's bill.
No, already rolled that. That's gone.
And then the bills that we specified we were rolling over in the beginning of the hearing, we didn't specify what day we were rolling them over to.
We should stand at ease if we could, just to collect a list or roll over for Monday.
Okay, well, we'll stand at ease for a few moments.
No problem.
Did we pick? Okay. We're rolling over to Monday. House Bill 3388, House Bill 2936, House Bill 2002, House Bill 2356, House Bill 3206, House Bill 3365, House Bill 3437, House Bill 3503, House Bill 3. House Bill 2320, House Bill 2902, House Bill 3498, House Bill 2324. We're adjourned. Thank you. 2-4.